And so we talk about like life-changing exits. You know, life-changing exits aren't always multi-millions of dollars. There can be a time when a very small exit can be life-changing. And I've worked with clients who even a $100,000 deal can be life-changing for them. So I know we talk about kind of the exit mindset and just like, let's not forget that it doesn't always take millions of dollars to change somebody's life.
This can't be it. There has to be more. Wait, am I crazy? No. If you're yearning for more and working hard to make your dreams a reality, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Dreamcatchers. It's the only show committed to helping you self-actualize and then transcend, leaving you with the legacy you've always desired. Listen in on conversations with successful philanthropists, entrepreneurs, and founders every week as we connect with them for inspiration, education, and direction. Your host, Jerome Myers, is here to help you exit the matrix and transform into a leader of your own revolution. The question is, do you believe your dreams should be real? Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Dreamcatchers podcast. I am your host, Jerome Myers, and I've got Marty in with me today. This guy has sold businesses of his own. He sold businesses for others. He's a Kansas City Chiefs fan. I don't know if you'll hold that against him or not, but they won the bowl.
Now so. Nobody's going to listen.
I don't know. There's a lot of fans out there. Winners like winners. And I think that's, when I think of Marty, I think of winners. He and I were speaking at a mastermind, and we had 10 minutes to present an idea. And I think there were 8 or 10 people who presented. And Marty and I were standing on stage, and they're like, one of you won and one of you didn't. Marty won. I told Marty he won before we went up there. And it was just cool to be on stage with him because his idea was really a solid one. And mine's, it was a little more squishy. So at the end of the day, I've got a tremendous amount of respect for Marty, and I think you are going to learn a lot. Get your pen and your pad ready. Get your notes open in Evernote, whatever you use. Because on the backside of this, if you want to exit or you've already exited, you are about to get some stuff that's going to help you on your journey. So, Marty, with that, welcome, man. So grateful.
Man, thank you for that introduction, Jerome. I voted for you, by the way. I loved your presentation that day. You know, I felt bad winning, but, you know, it brought us here together. And so I'm really glad to be here.
You should never feel bad for winning. The room spoke, and I appreciate your vote. So, Marty, you had an exit.
I've had a few of them.
Don't show off or anything. Okay, so let's go here because it's one of my favorite questions to ask. When was your first experience of somebody selling a business? Like, how did you know that you could do that? Because most people don't know that.
So I didn't know anything about it. I had a business. This was about 20. It's been almost 25 years ago now. I had a little business that some buddies and I started up. It was a little sporting goods product. Really cool little product. We did grassroots marketing, literally selling it at soccer fields on Saturday mornings with our kids. And at that time, my experience was direct response television. So like infomercials, home shopping, et cetera. And so we thought that would make a great TV product. And it was a great TV product. We put it on QVC and sold really well. We put it on television. We actually got it on QVC in Japan and did really, really well. And 18 months after starting, somebody called us up and said, hey, would you guys like to sell your business to us? And had no idea, none, what we were doing. And we said, okay. And they made us an offer and we said, okay. And then they sent us money and we said, okay. And then we moved on. It was the simplest, like weird, like, again, as you mentioned, like most people don't think about buying or selling businesses. And it certainly wasn't on our mind either. It was just one of those things where somebody called us up and offered us some money. And we said, okay. So 18 months later, after starting the business, we got $1.5 million offer for the business. And we took that cash and ran, which was great for a bunch of 20 something year olds. But one of the things that was interesting was that we took cash for the business and thought we were the smartest guys on the planet. What I learned later, as I followed through and started learning more about acquisitions and private equity and roll-ups and all sorts of things that I had no clue about at the time, was that I should have asked some questions. Now, we didn't get ripped off or anything. And a lot of times you go, well, I should ask more questions because I get ripped. We didn't get ripped off. We got money and we were all happy. But had I understood what was happening and who was buying us, I later learned it was a PE-backed roll-up in the sporting goods industry. And if we would have asked for some equity in the roll-up parent company, I calculated it out one time, and it could have been as much as $24 million. Because obviously we took like a, you know, 2x multiple, and we could have had maybe, you know, a much higher multiple because eventually it rolled up and went public. And so we thought we were the smartest guys in the planet taking some cash. And it turns out we left a ton of money on the table, but we didn't know what we were doing. And yeah, so that was my first exit.
I think most people who don't have advisors don't know what they're doing. Especially
I didn't even know that advisors existed. We didn't even know. We were like, oh, you want to give us some money? Okay. Where do we sign? That was it. And yeah, had somebody said, hey, you know, and like I said, we did okay. It wasn't like, I don't know that we would have gotten a ton more cash. I don't know that we would have gotten any better deal. And I don't even know if they would have given us some of the equity if we even asked for it. I just now know that, you know, I wish somebody would have at least, you know, been involved in the transaction to give us some advice and at least explore our options.
So did you decide to open up your advisory business on the backside of figuring that out? Or
no,
more exits?
I'm not nearly that smart. It took me years to figure out how to get that smart. No. So after that exit, and that was, again, that was a personal exit that I did. I then went to work for a company who was on the other side. We were actually doing acquisitions. And so I was managing the acquisitions side of things. We were doing e-commerce acquisitions. And so I started doing the other side. I just started doing roll-ups and started learning and understanding, oh, this is, you know, this is how this all works, and started really gaining understanding. I didn't have nearly enough experience to open an advisory firm at that time. I was still learning. So we did quite a few acquisitions at that time. And then we actually went public with that company as well. And that would have been considered my second exit, because I was, you know, I obviously had a ton of equity in that, and we went public, and that was a very nice payday as well. So that was my second exit. That wasn't me. It was part of a team, and part, it was a huge collaborative effort with, and funny, I was listening to some episodes of your podcast in preparation for this talk, and you had a guy on there, I can't remember his name, but he was talking about Kevin Harrington, and he knows Kevin Harrington and does some business with Kevin Harrington. So one of the acquisitions we made was actually Kevin Harrington's company. So I actually acquired Kevin Harrington's company back in 2003, I believe it was. It was a company called Reliant Interactive, and he and his brother Tim owned it. And so there was a brief period of time for about a year where Kevin and I worked together really closely, and we grew that business. It was part of the business. We grew that business from $80 million to $600 million in revenue, by the way. And
20 years?
About 2.5. Yeah.
So
huge growth.
Is it safe to say you're good at marketing?
I have a gift that I can create money out of thin air. And I don't know why I have it, but part of that is really, I love marketing. I love growing businesses. I love coming up with some crazy ideas that's going to get attention and serve the marketplace, and then executing that idea and then seeing the numbers come in. And I just love it. It's my passion. And so, you know, I'm as good as the next guy, I guess, but I'm probably a little more passionate than most.
I don't know many people who can say they went from 80 million to 600 million in 2 years, though.
Yep. Well, that was part of what gave Kevin his launching pad. Obviously, that was a pretty hefty, when we bought his company, that was a pretty hefty exit for him. And so we both participated in the overall exit when it went public. So
was there ever a point where you were like just like a regular old employee without ownership?
Oh, yeah. Leading up to that, I had several jobs that were just, I mean, you know, I started out just like anybody else working, you know, menial minimum wage job, doing my thing. Well, I'll tell you my origin story. You want my origin story real quick? I'll try and make it fast. So I married quite young. I had my first child quite young, and I was a telemarketer, minimum wage telemarketer, inbound telemarketer. I didn't call people and interrupt their dinner. I was an inbound. So people of a certain age will remember the phrase, operators are standing by. So you'd see a an ad on TV and to buy something and you'd call to order. This was pre-internet, right? I was one of those operators standing by, and $3.35 an hour is how much I made at that time. And I was sitting there one day and I was calculating and I realized that I had sold $10,000 worth of products in an hour and I got paid $3.35. And I said, hang on a minute, there's a lot of money in between here. How do I get my hands on some of this so that I can put shoes on my baby's feet and pay the rent? Yeah. And so through a series of steps over the next, 8 or 10 years, I worked my way from that into management, into sales, into marketing, eventually onto the product side, worked with growing and developing some products on television. And then that big roll up was back in the TV space. So I was taking phone calls for orders from people ordering items off of TV. And I eventually went on to be on the side of the product owners and the agency side, and eventually did $1 billion in revenue on television with all of that. So, but for the first 8 or 10 years, I was an employee. And then until I started realizing that, you can make good money as an employee, but you're never going to make life-changing money as an employee, probably.
Man. Okay. So you work through that and then you actually get into ownership, but it's not your deal. It's working with a group of people, and it's not
right.
The Marty show. It's Marty.
No, but I learned so much. I will never trade those years for anything. It was some of the craziest times we had. We were doing deals left and right, and we had 2 private planes. And when we, need to go somewhere, we just jump on the jet. It was fun times. It was fun times. And I learned, like I said, I learned so much about how to do deals and leverage and partnerships and joint ventures and merging strengths and to eliminate weaknesses and just thinking bigger and thinking strategically. I'd never trade that time for what I learned from it. And that was about a 4-year span of my life, my career. So I was technically an employee. I was the president of one of the divisions, but it was an incredibly entrepreneurial business. And I was in my division was, it was the beginnings of the internet. So I grew my division from $1.5 million to $30 million in revenue. And as part of that growth, and it was good times. So,
wow. Yeah. I remember my last job. We went from 0 to 20 million, and that was a wild ride. And it was entrepreneurial. It was as close to being an entrepreneur as I could get, but there is a difference. And so eventually you started your own deal, right?
So, I left that after we went public and I cashed out. We kind of things. When a company is privately held and it's a tight-knit team and it's doing $80 million a year and it goes to being a $600 million company with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of employees and everything else, and it goes public, it's an entirely different animal. And it requires different people to run it, different skill sets and everything else. I learned something at that time called Dunbar's number. You ever heard of Dunbar's number? So Dunbar's number it's an anthropological theory that was developed by a guy named Dunbar, who studied primates and studied even canines, like wolves, et cetera, and realized that there's sort of a magic number in any group or society where once you exceed that number, any one person is unlikely to be connected with every other person. Meaning, if 50 people, or if you have 50 people in your company, all 50 people. If you have 100 people in your company, all 100 people. Dunbar's number posits that 150 is the magic number. Once you cross that, you start to hit a point where there is the potential that one person's not going to know another person inside of a company. And I learned that I love companies that are under 150 employees, because once you cross that threshold, it's a different kind of entity. It's a different kind of business. Bureaucracy, silos, territorialism, red tape, you name it. And so I learned at that time that I don't want to be in a business that does $600 million a year. And I dedicated from that time, and this was almost 20 years ago, I dedicated from that time to focus primarily on entrepreneurial businesses, specifically ones less than 150 employees.
And focus on them in doing what? Is this marketing or something?
Growth, scaling. By that time, I was doing strategic advisory, sitting on boards and mergers and acquisitions.
Okay. So you ran companies, you built companies, you ran companies, you sold companies. What made you want to be an advisory? Because it's not, you don't have the control that you do when it's your deal.
Yeah. Let me tell you about my third exit.
Okay.
So I told you about my first exit, $1.5 million, two partners. My second exit was, hundreds of millions of dollars, but I had just a, small equity stake. It was substantial, but it was, not mine. My third exit was a little business I started, and we did something called teleseminars, which don't exist any longer, but way back, there used to be this thing called teleseminars, and it was the precursor to podcasts and Zooms and things like that. And it was, a lot of internet marketers would use it to sell product and do trainings and things like that. And basically, teleseminar was you get a whole bunch of people, up to hundreds or thousands of people on a live call, and you talk on the phone. And you do a seminar on the telephone. And it was the easiest technology because it's a 100-year-old technology. And there was a ton of money in it. You're smiling. So what do you know about teleseminars?
Well, I just think it's the old webinar, but I've listened to my share of teleseminars.
Yeah, exactly. It was before the webinar, it was the teleseminar. And actually, even long after the webinar became a thing, teleseminars remained really successful because webinars are full of glitches and problems and people can't log on and everything else. But teleseminars, like, if you can use a phone, you can join, right? So I started a business doing marketing and eventually production for teleseminars. And it was reasonably successful. I never intended to start that business. It was literally, I started doing teleseminars for my business. I was doing really well. And people said, hey, Marty, can you help me do this? Because I don't know what I'm doing, but I want to do this. And so, sure, I've got the team, I've got the people that can do this. And yeah, I'll just kind of like, I'll just set something up and you can pay us and we'll go do it for you. So from that grew a little business that I used to call my six-figure hobby. Now, I was at that time doing coaching, consulting, marketing, et cetera. But the teleseminar thing was kind of my six-figure hobby. It was a little side gig and it was doing, nice extra income, right? Fast forward to 2008 and the housing bubble crashes and the economy goes completely in the toilet. My businesses actually were doing better than most. I had a great 2008. I was watching like wasteland of things happening around me, but my business was doing great. Come into 2009 and I'm still doing great. Things are getting worse and I'm going, man, I don't know why, but I seem to be exempt from all this devastation. March of 2009, the hammer comes down and I had my number one client who stiffed me for $300,000 and my number two client terminated their contract all in the same week, March of 2009. I remember it very vividly. And that was a heavy hit. And that $300,000 that I got stiffed on, probably $200,000 of that was stuff I had to pay out for production costs and things like that to my team, et cetera. So it wasn't just like gravy. It was like money that I owed to other people. So very quickly, I needed to raise some capital. And I looked around and said, well, what have I got that I can raise capital? And I had that little business. And I said, well, I wonder if somebody would want it. I still, even though I'd gone from selling that first original business, and then I was doing big multi-million dollar mergers and acquisitions, and now I've got this little six-figure business. And I still didn't really know how to do that, but I just kind of winged it. And I wound up selling that business for $500,000. Now, Jerome, I know you have people on your show who've had exits of tens of millions, hundreds of millions. I mean, truly life-altering generational numbers.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, though, that sell was the most life-altering sell for me. It was because if I didn't close that deal, I was going to lose my house.
Ooh.
If I didn't close that deal, I wasn't going to be able to pay my bills. It came at a time, like I said, I had people that I owed money to, and the people that owed me money had filed bankruptcy, and I was in deep trouble. And so we talk about like life-changing exits. You know, life-changing exits aren't always multi-millions of dollars. There can be a time when a very small exit can be life-changing. And I've worked with clients who even a $100,000 deal can be life-changing for them. So I know we talk about kind of the exit mindset and just like, let's not forget that it doesn't always take millions of dollars to change somebody's life.
Man, that's so good. Because I think so many people just get caught up in this concept of, I've got to get tens of millions of dollars in order for this to be worth it. But it could just be staying in the game, not running out of runway, right?
And that's absolutely
what you were doing. You didn't want to run out of runway. You didn't want to file bankruptcy, which, you know, for some people, it's an okay alternative. For a lot of us, though, that's not okay, because that means somebody who believed in us, trusted us, isn't going to get what we promised them to get.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now how does that lead to answering your question? It's a long answer to get to your question. So how did I get into advisory? So suffered through the, you know, that recession, and things started to improve. And I went back to doing a lot of coaching, consulting, and I did a lot of consulting for equity. So I was taking ownership in a lot of businesses, taking small minority ownership in a lot of businesses, doing like half cash, half equity. My goal was always to own a large portfolio of businesses. And so I started that because a lot of businesses were struggling. They didn't have a lot of cash to pay me, but they'd be willing to give equity. And so I said, okay, great, let's work something out. I still got to have some cash to pay my bills, but let's see what we can work out. So I started doing a lot of small minority equity deals in a lot of different businesses. Some of them worked out really, really great. Some of them didn't. But I started really seeing the power of having those dividends coming through, those profit shares coming through, et cetera. And I got to a point where I was regularly going to my mailbox and pulling out checks that I didn't know were coming. And those are always great, right? Fast forward a few years, and I launched a couple more companies. I did one that was, we launched from scratch. We did $24 million in about 3 or 4 years. And then November of 2019, I was in China, and I was working on a project, and I was watching this thing called SARS. They weren't calling it COVID yet. I was watching what's happening in China, and I'm like, something weird's happening. And I got back to the US and I immediately said, something big is happening. And I told everybody I knew, like, stock up on stuff, save your cash, stock up on food, stock up on everything, be prepared, because something bigger than we've ever seen is coming. And I want everybody to be prepared. Interestingly, about 90% of the people I told that to laughed at me and said, you're crazy. And of course, in March, the whole world shut down, March of 2020. So at the time when that was happening, I said, you know, I'm not worried about the disease. I think the disease is not what is concerning me. I said, I'm worried about the economy. I'm worried about what this is going to do to small businesses. I'm worried about what this is going to do to inflation. I'm worried about what this is going to do to interest rates. Like, I kind of saw everything we have today early on. And it's, you know, like I said, most people were kind of calling me a kook or a conspiracy theorist or whatever else. But it was pretty obvious what was going to happen. You can't print trillions of dollars and hand it out to people, and you can't shut down the economy around the world. You can't do those things without major things happening. So I looked around. I said, you know, a lot of businesses, now this was before, from the time that we shut down the world to the time that the, especially in the United States, we had EIDL and PPP. There was a couple of months there where there was no hope. Like, businesses were like, you know, really in trouble and going out of business left and right. And how do you keep your doors open? So I formed a group of people who were investors and visionaries. And I said, look, let's go out and try, and started putting the word out that, hey, if you're a business and you're struggling and you're shut down, whatever, and, you know, let's help you. We'll give you some investment to keep your bills paid, even if you can't operate, whatever. And so we started doing outreach, and we just got flooded with business owners, like, I need help. And so we'd look at businesses and look at deals and we'd be like, okay, great. We can work something out here or we can work, but most of them, you know, unfortunately, 99 out of 100 businesses we looked at, we couldn't do anything with. They would just, the investment was too risky or, you know, didn't fit our thesis or just whatever. And so we'd say, hey, great. Thanks for, you know, talking to us, but unfortunately we're not going to be able to do this deal. And the response was unanimously the same. It was, okay, if you aren't, can you find somebody who can help? Well, that's not really what we do, but I have a soft spot, right? One of the things that I've never learned how to do effectively is say no. I've always been told my biggest problem is I need to learn how to say no. Well, I didn't say no. I said, let me see what I can do. And so I started connecting businesses who were looking for investment or looking to sell with people who are looking to buy them and looking to acquire or invest. And the advisory firm was born, and that's where it's been ever since. Secretly, opening my kimono, secretly, what Westbound Road is as an advisory firm is it's a huge funnel that just brings me the best deals possible. So I just look at everything that comes across and I cherry pick my favorite ones and the rest of them go to market. But don't tell anybody that.
I won't, but I think it's amazing that you've created deal flow for your post-exit portfolio. And right. So in our framework, founders have 80 exits. Exit 6 is the one they talk about where they get 6, 7, 8 figure check based on whatever the valuation of the company was. And then they have to take and deploy those resources against their post-exit portfolio. They become a resource allocator. And so for you to build your post-exit portfolio, of course, you want to have the opportunity to look at as many businesses as possible. Of course, you want to take the ones that you want for your portfolio before other people get them. And of course, you want to help them even if they aren't a good fit for you because they came to you to solve the problem of selling their business. And so I think it's the optimal solution. Now, you slipped something in that I don't think most people get.
Uh-oh.
You said a term. Some people say CFE is an abbreviation, but you say you were consulting for equity. Now, for people out there, when they think about buying and selling stuff, they don't think about consulting as a tool for bartering or gaining things. And so can you talk a little bit about the strategy of consulting for equity and maybe what skills you used in order to demonstrate that you had something that they could use to help them get more money on the back end? Because I think in most instances, that's the promise when somebody consults for equity.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I've been doing consulting for equity for over 20 years and I didn't even know it was called that term. I don't know who actually created that term. I've only heard it really in the last 4 or 5 years, but I didn't really have a term. But so consulting for equity, let me give you an example. So you have a business and you're a business owner and you have, let's say your business is doing $2 million a year and maybe you've flatlined and like your marketing's not working anymore. And so, you know, Facebook's changed their algorithms and Google Gmail's changed their algorithms and all of a sudden you're not able to keep up. And so you're like, what do I do? So you go out and you hire a marketing agency to handle your social media advertising or to handle your email advertising or whatever. And you pay a large amount of money to this marketing agency to go and do this. And you hope that it works, but it doesn't always. But you probably wrote a pretty big fat check for that. All right. So consulting for equity would be that marketing agency comes in and says, look, we can do what you need to do. We can get your business back on track and grow your business by 20% a year, 30% a year, whatever it is. But instead of you as the business owner writing a check and just paying them cash, they will take a piece of equity in your business so that you don't have to write that check. And they will do what they say they're going to do in exchange for that equity. And then they will own a piece of your business in perpetuity because they literally have equity in it. So the win-wins can be from, as a business owner, you can get things done that you don't have to lay cash out for. And because it's the compensation is equity based versus just fee based, you're more likely to be able to tie performance to it, actual performance. Like they've got to do what they say they're going to do before they get that equity. For the person doing the consulting for equity, it's an opportunity. So I've had deals where as a consultant, I might've charged $25,000 for a service I provided, you know, for a couple of months of coaching or whatever. But if I do an equity deal and the business does really well, I might make $200,000 over the next couple of years. So, but the business is grateful to have my services without having to write me a check. And I'm grateful that over time I make substantially more money and add to my portfolio. And this can be done with any type of kind of service. So I've seen consulting for equity. Obviously, marketing is the number one thing I see all the time. People are really good marketers. It's easy to measure. It's performance-based, et cetera, sales, marketing, et cetera. I've seen consulting for equity, though, in the financial CFOs. A lot of businesses are terrible. They, you know, they're terrible financials. They're, you know, their books are a mess, or they don't have good strategy with the financial strategy. So if you're an accountant or a chief financial officer, you can do consulting for equity. If you are really good at operations, a lot of businesses have a visionary as a president or an owner, but they aren't really strong operationally. If there's a good operations person who can come in and straighten out your business and make it more efficient and make it more profitable, they might have a consulting for equity option that they can do. So any kind of category, any type of service that can be rendered to a business can be done as a consulting for equity versus just payment in cash. And it may be a better option for both parties. There's a term for this long before consulting for equity and long before I even started doing it 20 years ago. There's a 100-year-old term for this called barter that, you know, even in the agrarian society, you trade a bushel of wheat for a cow or whatever, and no money has to change hands and everybody wins. And it's just really a much, much more modernized version of that.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I think there's a lot of people who want to build a portfolio of companies and the ownership in them, but they have no idea how to get out of trading their time mm-hmm. for money.
Yeah.
And what you've done is say, measure me based on my results.
Sure.
And now you've got to be able to deliver results to
absolutely. Or you'll be consulting for nothing.
Yeah. A lot of people want to unlock their ultimate potential but lack the strategy, support, and stamina necessary to achieve their major goals. They often try to overcome these challenges by trying to do it on their own, causing frustration, fatigue, and eventually failure. We have developed a model for a center life, aka the red pill, to help them bolster their beliefs, gain clarity on their path to success, and provide accountability as they take action on their goals. When they take the red pill, they rapidly accelerate attainment of their goals and begin to experience a life of significance and impact. Want to find out more? Hop over to JeromeMyers.co. Now, let's get back to the episode. I've watched a lot of people do that. Now, you got to protect yourself in some ways too, because you aren't the owner of the company. And so you can have a strategy that'll work, but they got to implement. And there's probably some execution necessary.
Absolutely.
As a result of that too.
Yeah.
So, all right. You sell businesses.
Yes, sir.
At one point, I made the mistake of saying the word broker. And you had a visceral reaction.
Were we at dinner when you said that? Was this, yeah, I think we had a good conversation at dinner.
Visceral reaction about the word broker. So can you tell me a little bit about your approach to business transactions and how brokers get it wrong? And why advisors is what you should be looking for when you're looking for help, so that you're not, you know, one of the kids that are happy to sell their business for $1.5 million and just get their check and leaving all the money on the table on the backside.
Absolutely. Thanks for asking that question. And I forgot we had that conversation. So not to disparage business brokers, but I'm going to quote a statistic that is publicly verifiable on the IBBA website, which is the International Business Brokers Association. And that is that business brokers have a success rate on average between 15 and 20% of the businesses they represent for sale actually get sold. 15 to 20%. That's verifiable on the IBBA website. I don't know of very many industries that can thrive as a multi-billion dollar industry with a 15 to 20% success rate outside of maybe weather forecasters and I don't even know what else. That's my first issue. And why is that? Well, there's a couple of reasons. So number one is a reason that's not fair to the industry, but it's common. And that is that business brokers are transactional based only, meaning you come to them when you're ready to sell or you're ready to buy a business, and they facilitate a transaction for a moment of time, and their compensation is cash taken out of the transaction. So a lot of them are kind of glorified real estate agents. What's different about an advisor is that we get involved in the transaction, hopefully, 2 years in advance. If you're thinking about selling your business in the next even 2 to 3 years, that's when you want us involved. Why? Because there are a million things to do to get your business ready to be sold at that time, to prepare it for succession planning, to get the highest valuation, et cetera. So we are not purely transactional based. We are going to advise you on how to get that business where you want it to be, when you want it to be there. Second is, when I first started aggressively doing my own acquisitions 4 or 5 years ago, I worked with a lot of business brokers because that's where businesses were, I thought. And it's a hopelessly outdated, behind the times industry. There was I attended a webinar with a business broker on how to operate a great business brokerage right after I started Westbound Road as an advisor. He's like, okay, I want to learn from the best. They were talking, this was in 2021, and they were talking about faxing NDAs. They still fax NDAs. I'm like, who has a fax machine? Who uses, like, are you kidding me? In the year 2021, you're faxing documents? So I couldn't believe it. So since that time, I've had many, many, many business owners and business buyers come to me and they're like, oh my gosh, I was working with so-and-so broker. I tried to work with so-and-so broker. And it's just a really, really tough. And it doesn't surprise me that their success rate is so low. So even though by the very textbook definition of a broker, which is a person that facilitates a transaction between a buyer and seller, like sort of we are, the reality is we're much more than that. The other thing is, we aren't always looking for cash. We like to take equity positions in the right deals. And so it is not out of the realm of possibility that we will get involved in a transaction and not take any cash because we want to be part of the right deals. And so and business brokers won't do that. So we're truly a partner, oftentimes an equity partner in the deals that we're facilitating and advising. And that's a huge difference. And so what that leads to for us, now I wish it was 100%. There's just no possible way to get success rate to 100% in this, but our success rate is 78.2%. So if you are thinking about buying or selling a business, you can go with a broker and have a 15 to 20% success rate, or you can work with somebody like us and have a 78.2% success rate. That's the biggest difference.
Well, I've never actually seen a broker be excited to participate in the deal. So there's a success rate, but there's also partnership, right? And it sounds to me aligning outcomes, and this kind of goes back to the consulting for equity thing, aligning the outcomes so that everybody gets what they want out of it.
Exactly.
And that is magic for people out there who are questioning whether or not the person is there. I'm so glad that you brought up the transaction thing because it's one of my pet peeves. I watch so many people vanish on the backside of the transaction. It is, how can we get this person to close, whether it's the best thing for them or not? Mm-hmm. And then we leave them on the backside with nothing except for their check. Mm-hmm. And everybody acts as if they're supposed to be okay, but the people are going through the founder's exit paradox. They are struggling with what life is after the company is sold, especially if they've had it 15, 20, 40 years.
For sure.
because their identity is wrapped up in it. It's a ball. They are one and the same. It is a part of them. And that in and of itself is something that so many people kind of shrug their shoulder at and say, you got money, figure it out. And that isn't the answer. And so one of the things that I admire most about you is your passion for things outside of the businesses that you own, have owned. And like you talk about your grandkids and you just light up like a Christmas tree. You talk about riding your Harley and it's just like, this guy has both ends of the spectrum, right? He's the manly guy who's out on the Harley with his leathers. And then he's pulling up to the grandkids thing and showing up in a way that so few are fortunate to experience. I never got to have a relationship with my grandfather. So it's one of the things I'm envious of, but it's also something that I wanted to make sure that my daughters had. And so like to see you living it out and from all intents and purposes, as best I understand it, and I feel like I've spent enough time with you to have this assessment, you're living on purpose and in purpose, and you haven't confused what's important and what's not, and you put those things in a specific order. And so I say all that to give you a compliment, because I don't think men actually hear that stuff very frequently.
Well, thank
about
you.
Having priorities outside of business. But it's also kind of walking down the plank, because you had to learn that somewhere. And I suspect that you didn't get it right in the beginning. So how did you arrive at this place where you have centeredness and you know that your identity isn't completely tied to your business?
I have no idea. I don't have no idea how I got there. I will, first of all, thank you for that compliment. And I have endeavored to have balance without question all my life. Even when I was young, when I had young kids and whatnot, I tried my hardest to have in my career, and part of why I've been an entrepreneur more than I've been an employee is because it gave me time flexibility I tried to be there for the baseball games, for the basketball games, for the karate, for scouts. I think your wife and I talked about scouts for a while. You know, I've been in scouting for 18 years now and a scout leader. I've tried to be there for my kids when they were younger. I've tried to be there for my grandkids. I've tried to have that balance. I've tried to travel and see the world and do fun things and not just work 24/7. I don't know where I've come from that. I just knew, and certainly have not been completely successful at it. I'm definitely better at it today than I was when I was younger. My kids will tell you, my kids will tell you, and they're all grown up now and everything, but they'll tell you that, you know, they remember me being at things than when a lot of parents weren't. But they'll also tell you I wasn't at everything, and which is, you know, I did travel a lot for business. I traveled internationally a lot. There were times I was gone, but I've tried to balance that out, because when it's all said and done, you know, you've got to think about what legacy you're leaving behind, and whether you're, you know, this is tied to your founder's exit paradox, right? It's like the end result isn't just selling your business and having a huge amount of money. The end result is what legacy are you leaving behind? You know, when you're gone, what are people going to say about you? What are people going to think about you? What footprints did you leave in their hearts and minds and souls? I've definitely been less than successful at where I want to be from that standpoint, but I'm trying every day.
Alex Hormozi has been on a tear recently saying legacy doesn't matter, and a generation from now or two generations from now, nobody's going to know who you are. And I struggle with that because, I mean, plenty of people know who the Vanderbilts are, you know, the Rockefellers, like there are the Trumps, like there are names that people know. And so what keeps us from doing the same thing? What keeps us from having that level of impact?
Yeah, I have a quick story for you. So my grandfather owned a general contracting business in a reasonably small town in Utah. And I have a very unique last name, right? Fonky. If somebody out there, you bump into them and they have my last name, I'm related to them, period. We're all related. And by the way, I'm the only Marty Fonky in the entire world. So if you you know, I can't hide, right? I'm easy to find. Am I easily Googleable? But when I was younger, my dad sat me down and he said, you know, your grandfather has worked since he came home from World War II. He has worked hard to build his business and build a reputation in this community for building quality homes and quality buildings and a quality family. And if you ever screw up, everybody in town will know whose grandkid you are. You can't hide. It's a small town and you have a unique name. And that really impressed upon me, like, man, that's really true. That's really true. And 40 years later, probably 40 years later, my son, who at that time was like, I don't know, 19, 20, something like that, had applied for a job, completely different town, completely different state, 1,200 miles away. We had moved. He applied for a job and he got an interview, and he's deaf, by the way. And so he asked me to go and interpret for him. I can interpret sign language for my son. And so I'm like, sure, I'll go. And I walk in and the guy, the manager of the establishment said, I saw that last name come in on the application and I had a feeling it was you that was connected. So who is he? And I said, he's my son. And he goes, okay, it doesn't matter how the interview is going to go. I'm going to hire him, but let's do the interview anyway. And I told my son, and it was because I had been a customer. It was at an automotive shop. I'd been a customer of that shop for several years and I treated everybody with respect. I, you know, was just a nice guy, which they don't always have happen. And I sat my son down and I said, this is what I mean. I said, he saw your name come across, our last name, come across a stack of job applications, and he saw the name and he put it at the top because of the value of our name. And I said, and now you got the job because you interviewed and then you kept the job because you're good. But that little edge that you put you at the top of the stack was because we've kept our good name. So you don't have to be a Vanderbilt or a Rockefeller or a Trump for your name to have a positive impact on your kids, your grandkids, or the community. It can be a simple little thing, but to me, it's an important thing.
To me too. That just gave me goosebumps. And, you know, when I think about Kaya and Leah and the doors that my work can open for them, and then the people that come behind them, it's like, how do you not do that? And what's really cool about it is you can do it for your household, but there's so many other people in the world that you can impact positively as well. And I went to a funeral on a Saturday, and it was a guy who's 52, his aorta tore, and he died at home. He was home alone, so nobody could help him. And, you know, he probably had 5% body fat, Marty. I mean, he was ripped up, totally in shape. And, you know, when people went up and started talking about him, it just did something to my soul about how kind and gentle he was and how loyal he was. And it was just words that would make any person proud to be associated with him. And to think that your name is that represents those things, and that people can get opportunity as a result of the way that you've lived your life, I don't know what greater honor there is. And so I encourage folks to not let their business be their greatest success, right? But to actually live out a legacy, and on the backside of your exit, having proceeds that you can invest for a lasting legacy. So it's not just the effort of your time, but you're able to use leverage with capital and relationships and whatever energy you're ready to put into it, in addition to your talents. I think it gives you opportunity to just make a massive impact. And that ripple effect from the stone that you drop into the puddle can go places that you can't even imagine. And so, I mean, you're doing that in your own way, and I think it's showing up in a very meaningful way with that tangible example that you just gave us. So thank you so much for making that real in a world where people are diminishing it under the guise of just do what makes you happy, because you can't actually have impact that you want to have. I think every parent would be proud to be able to have that level of impact for their little people. But I think it extends even further than that. When I think about the exit, I think a lot of people expect the money to do something for them that it won't ever do, and that's to make them happy and give them fulfillment. Because you partner with the folks who decide to use your firm for disposition, I suspect that you talk to them after the deal is done.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would love, because I think you've got a pretty broad subset of insight, what do people, can we myth bust a little bit? What do people think the backside of an exit is going to be? And what is the rude awakening that they experience? If maybe you had the top three?
I'm not sure I can answer that one, actually. We've had the pleasure in luck, maybe, of most of our exits that we've worked with have had pretty darn good outcomes. The folks that we've worked with who've sold their businesses and retired have been very happy in their retirement. And, you know, we still stay in touch with them and get messages from Cabo and, hey, thanks again. Like, here, hey, I'm on the beach. And this, you know, this is what I was looking for, kind of thing. The many of our exits that we've advised, we tend to work with a lot of entrepreneurial folks who are exiting to go and do some new passion. And so, and again, we stay in touch with them and work with them. And matter of fact, we've had more than one person now come back for their second exit already. And so we haven't had that kind of, I've listened to your show. I know who you kind of address, and we've been very blessed that we just haven't had too much of that kind of like, oh my gosh, what have I done? For the most part, I can't even think of an exit that wasn't just an absolute positive experience in the life of the person who's exiting. I'm hoping it continues to be that way. I would probably say the only thing that I've seen, which is not even a huge thing, but the only thing I've seen is that not all of them have planned properly for the taxes. Mm-hmm. Even though we've told them, like, you must have a tax professional to go over all of this with you and understand the implications and so on and so forth. And the ones who've listened to us have been very grateful because they might have been making decisions that weren't the right decisions and whatnot. But some of them just have not listened to us. And then they've gotten burned a little bit on taxes because and some countries are horrible. And we do a lot of international business. We do 60% of our deals are international. So, and we can't possibly begin to understand the tax law of every single country in the world. And so we strongly recommend that they get a tax professional, advise them all the way through the process from the beginning to the end. And we've had a couple who've come back and like, oh man, that bit me and I wasn't expecting it. So that's kind of the only thing I've seen, honestly, Joel.
So do the folks that you're working with already have their necks figured out? Do they know what they're going to do on the backside of their...
Yeah, a lot of them. Uh-huh.
And I think that is the difference. When people decide that they're going to exit and they're going from a whole lot to nothing, they experience a pure void, and that void just gets them lost and they're in a valley. And
yeah,
sometimes people don't come back out of that valley.
Yeah. Some of our clients that have had businesses that are longstanding, you know, you talked about some of those, you know, 15, 20, 25 year long businesses, and they're like, you would expect to see much more struggle emotionally. But for the most part, they've just been like, finally, I'm retired. So it's been mostly just good stuff.
Outstanding. They were ready to get out and they were able to actually have the financial liquidity event that they deserve with so much of their wealth wrapped up or tied up in the business that they built.
Right.
Marty, I'd love to wrap these episodes up with the final question of, what's the one thing you want listeners to take away from the episode? Because we've covered a whole lot of ground today.
One thing I want them to take away. I don't know. What's the biggest thing you took away from this?
Oh, legacy is a real thing. Like the story about your dad talking about your grandfather and the fact that you can't hide and your name is your name. And then you seeing it open doors for your son. I mean, literally that story affected four generations.
No,
your grandfather set the standard. Your father lived it out. He told you how important it was. It created an opportunity where you had a teachable moment for your son who, I mean, he watched your example. So I'm sure he was already doing what he needed to be doing anyway, but because he watched your example, he was doing the things that needed to be done. That is just so powerful for me. And it's living proof that dreams should be real. Like, I think your dad and maybe your grandfather, they dreamed of the day where the name would stand on its own without somebody being there and represent or open a door, or create something. And I just think so many people are caught up in, well, this feels good right now, and so that means I should do it, even if they know that it's going to create issues long term. I think you can ruin a family name with one decision.
And without question,
that is something that a lot of us want to avoid if we absolutely can.
I love that answer. So there you go. There's my answer. That's my key takeaway I want people to take away. Thank you for answering that question for me.
So good, man. Marty, thank you for being a dream catcher. Thank you for helping others catch their dream. And thank you for being a professional in the M&A space who makes sure that people are set up to have the exit that they deserve to have. After building a big enterprise, the struggles that a lot of people go through, I feel are unwarranted, and it's only because they're unprepared. And so you talked about 2 years before getting involved and helping people go down that path so that they can have the exit.
Yeah.
And I think some people just want to show up, sign the contract, and then get their check. And that just doesn't end up being optimal for folks. And so if you're out there and you're concerned about figuring out what your next is and you don't know, you can check out our website at exittoexcellence.com. Marty, if people want to get in touch with you and find more about your services, how should they do that?
Yeah, they can go to our website at westboundroad.com. Google my name. I'm the only Marty Fonke on the planet. Or I'm really active on LinkedIn, where I share a lot of content and tips and advice and inspiration and actual tactical knowledge about acquisitions. And so feel free to check me out there.
Outstanding. To the listeners, your dreams should be real. We'll catch you on the next episode.
Thank you for joining the tribe today. We would love to hear from you. Please don't forget to rate, like, and share. Perhaps someone you know could benefit from what we've discussed. Until the next time, remember that your dreams should be real.